Good morning, everyone. I know Jim Anderson and Barbara, Fred and Molly. It's a pleasure meeting you. I'm the Director of Tribal Affairs and the senior most tribal liaison for the department. And I'm also coming to you from the Macaw Indian Reservation. I'm a member of the Macaw tribe. And on my grandmother's side, I'm a member of the Takelma people, one of the confederated tribes of Siletz in Oregon. So we'll go ahead and get started. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do the first half of this, this first hour on tribes in general, some of the history, some of the structure of the tribal government, how they're structured, and then just the big picture. And then we'll narrow it down with Joe Pinesco's second half of this presentation on the mechanics and the legalities. So I'll just go ahead and get started here. So presently, there's 574 recognized tribes in the United States. That's federally recognized. There's 29 federally recognized tribes in Washington state. There's actually about seven, I believe, non-recognized tribes as well that don't have any federal recognition. The tribes we work with most are, of course, treaty tribes. There's 21 treaty tribes, 20 in Western Washington, and then you add the Yakima Nation. There's a couple other tribes that are out of state, like the Nez Perce and the Umatilla, that have ceded traditional lands that expand into Washington state. At treaty time, when it was Washington territory, it was pretty expansive, and a lot of the tribal traditional lands overlapped, and so the Nez Perce, they sprawl into Oregon and Washington state, and then there's a couple others as well. In Washington state, we have 8 executive order tribes. Those are tribes that are recognized by executive order. We have tribes with fishing rights, with off-reservation fishing rights. That would be your 21 treaty tribes. With hunting for off-reservation, we have 24 tribes with off-reservation hunting rights. And that includes the 21 treaty tribes and the Nez Perce and the Umatilla. And then Colville has off-reservation hunting rights to a certain extent north of their reservation. They call it the north half that goes up to the Canadian border. And then I talked about tribes outside of the state. So we're going to kind of touch on history of tribal governments, the cultural relevance and the differences, awareness of the native lifeways, social characteristics, stewardship, and shared management and responsibilities that the state and the tribes have. The professional perspective, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the resiliency of the tribes. The tribes have come a long way since pre-contact until today. So I put this slide up. Culture is not a divide, and it shouldn't be in the work that we do. And I put a photo of my great-great-grandfather, Landis Kalapa. And actually, if I go back, that's my great-great-great-grandfather, Chief George Harney. He was the first chief of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz, and he went to D.C. to witness the treaty where the Senate approved the treaty, ratified the treaty, that is. So although Indian tribes are sovereign, that sovereignty is not absolute. It's been challenged, defined, and battled over throughout history. Tribes have come a long way. This is the history of tribal governments or tribes. Tribes have been here for since time immemorial, and when you talk to tribes, they've always been here, way before the European contact, and historically, a lot of tribes have different stories about their culture, their where they come from, and how they've came to be here. My tribe, the Macaw tribe, they believe that when the earth was covered with water, the orca that lived in the ocean went through a transformation, and he grew legs and he pulled himself out onto the beach, and he transformed into a wolf, and then wolf walked up towards the shoreline and stood up on his hind feet, and he transformed into man. And so we believe that we're all connected. So Native people have lived in organized societies with their own forms of government for thousands of years. And what I mean by that is their societies were very complex, with a lot of your coastal tribes, for example, and for that matter, most all your tribes had, royalty, which were the chief families. You had a grand chief, and then you had sub-chiefs. You had leaders in the community, family leaders, and then you had the royalty. Then you also had the commoners and people that were just more of the common folks. And then we also had slaves, so that made up a lot of these tribal communities. And unlike today, where we have elected officials in tribal communities, the makeup of the tribal societies were organized in a way like, how can I describe it? Hereditary would be the word, I guess you would say, hereditary tribal leadership. Well, way before European descent on the West Coast, the ancient Chinese explorers traded with coastal tribes in the early 1400s and even before. We had the Spanish explorers in 1513, explorer Vasco Nunez Balboa, the first European to sight the Pacific Ocean. Then he claimed all the lands adjacent to the ocean as belonging to Spain. He claimed it. In the vicinity of, in the Seattle area, actually, in the vicinity of the Duwamish River and Elliott Bay, in 1851, the U.S. settlers began building cabins and occupied, the Duwamish occupied 17 villages at that time in the area. The settlers moved in and started farming. So getting back to how Nunez claimed the West Coast, for example, the 15th century doctrine of discovery. I don't know how familiar you all are of that, but the papal bulls of the 15th century gave Christian explorers the right to claim lands they discovered and lay claim to those lands for their Christian monarchs. Any land that was not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited. If the pagan inhabitants could be converted, they might be spared. If not, they would be enslaved or killed. So the doctrine of discovery was something that came out of the Vatican, I believe, and then just basically stated rights to claim any land by indigenous cultures. So in the colonial period, 1792, the U.S. Secretary of State at that time was Thomas Jefferson, declared that the doctrine of discovery would extend from Europe to the United States government. The doctrine and its legacy continue to influence American imperialism and treatment of indigenous peoples. The proliferation of colonists created a dominant presence on the East Coast. These colonists acquired Indian lands under the doctrine of discovery and then later signed treaties with tribes for additional land as they moved westward. Following the Revolutionary War, the newborn United States took pains to remain to maintain peace with the neighboring tribes, but pressure from settlers resulted in increased encroachment, conflict, and bloodshed over land. So there was a lot of tragedy and a lot of negative history that was literally untold in school books, but some of the massacres and things that had happened, like the mass execution of the 38 Dakota men the day after Christmas in 1862 in Minnesota. That mass execution was the largest mass execution ever, and that was ordered by Abraham Lincoln. So while Lincoln was freeing the slaves, he was making orders like this. We've heard about the Wounded Knee Massacre. And then here in Washington State, and primarily in Western Washington, the smallpox epidemic, where the smallpox virus was spread purposely in tribal communities by infecting wool blankets and then giving them out as gifts. The removal, reservation, and treaty period, as the U.S. population and its military strength grew, so did the pressure of the U.S. government on eastern tribes to move west, resulting in forced migration and creation of treaty reservations. The United States had given, embarked on an aggressive military policy throughout the West to establish Indian reservations through treaties acquiring more Indian land. In general, the treaties relinquished land for the right for tribal self-governance on reservations with the protection of the U.S. government. So the Western Washington treaties, well, actually, the Stevens treaties were across Washington and even included, the Yakima and the Walla Walla Treaty and the Nez Perce. So pretty much the whole state. A treaties a formally a concluded and ratified agreement between two sovereign nations. Treaties are signed by the president and must be approved by two-thirds of the United States Senate to be ratified. In 1853, Isaac Stevens was appointed governor of the newly created Washington Territory by President Franklin Pierce. He was appointed that position as a reward for helping Franklin Pierce win his candidacy. He helped him campaign, and so he received this new job to govern the Washington Territory. One of Stevens' first tasks was to negotiate and impose treaties on the Indian nations of Western Washington. And well, I should take that Western word out and just say Washington. The U.S. Constitution, Article 6, says the U.S. Constitution, federal laws, and federal treaties shall be the supreme law of the land and binding on states. So that's pretty significant. And so treaties are pretty much law. Western Washington treaties, like many politicians of the era, Isaac Stevens was a firm believer of the concept of manifest destiny and viewed Indians as a barrier to the inevitable development of American civilization. His task was to consolidate the tribal nations into reservations and free the land for non-native development. In order to streamline the treaty process, Stevens created a boilerplate language for the treaties with very similar basic wording in those treaties. Stevens saw the Indians as a single group rather than autonomous sovereign nations. He was unaware of the cultural differences between the different Indian nations or different tribes. There's different linguistic groups and different cultures. The tribes here in Washington really contrast each other, from your coastal tribes, your Coast Salish, to your plains tribes on the Far East. But in the treaty, some of the language read the right of taking fish at usual and accustomed grounds and stations is further secured to said Indians in common. And I highlighted in common, and we'll talk about that phrase a little later when Joe Pinesco gets into his part of the presentation. But in common with other citizens of the territory, and erecting temporary houses for the purpose of curing them, together with the privileges of hunting, gathering roots and berries, and pasturing their horses on open and unclaimed lands. I should highlight open and unclaimed lands as well, because that's another phrase in the treaty that I'm sure Joe Pinesco will talk about later on. And when we think about treaty rights, we think about fishing and hunting and natural resources, but treaty rights also include an assured health care, social services, and housing, education. So treaty rights mean a lot to the tribes, or the tribes that have those treaty rights, I should say. A couple examples. Here's one example and this is Chief Leschi. He is born in 1808 near what is today Eatonville, Washington. A Nisqually father to a Nisqually father and a Yakima mother. He was recognized as a leader and a chief by Isaac Stevens to represent Nisqually and Puyallup tribes at the Medicine Creek Treaty signing on December 26, 1854, which ceded the United States all or part of the present-day King County, Pierce, Lewis, Grays Harbor, Mason, and Thurston counties. Some maintain there's a number of stories about Chief Leschi and in different interpretations. Some maintain that Leschi either refused to sign or had his signature or his X forged by another or forced to sign under protest. So Leschi protested after the treaty was put into place, and in the following year or year and a half, Leschi and other tribal men that from many tribes in Puget Sound objected and fought, and there were a number of scrimmages, you know, battles throughout the Puget Sound area. And on the morning of January 26, 1856, after months of raids and clashes with federal troops in southern King County and Thurston County, Native Americans attacked Seattle. Previously warned by local natives, most settlers had barricaded themselves in this big, huge block house. The attackers were then finally driven off by artillery fire and cannons by the U.S. Navy sloop of war Decatur. It was a Navy ship anchored in Elliott Bay. This is Chief Seattle, a photograph of Chief Seattle. He was Suquamish and Duwamish. I think it goes, his father was Suquamish and his mother was Duwamish in the Seattle area. There's a famous speech you can Google and look up, but I took a few excerpts out of his speech from 1854. He gave this speech to Isaac Stevens, and some of the phrases in that speech where the rivers are our brothers. The air is precious, for all things share the same breath. The earth does not belong to man, man belongs to the earth. If we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. Care for it as we have cared for it. And we may be brothers after all. Chief Seattle was a real brilliant leader, and there's his grave site. We took a photo of that's over at Suquamish, just over near Poulsbo. So, getting back into the history of things, the Allotment Act went on from 1887 to 1934. An increasing greed for the land within the reservations and the desire to have Indians assimilated to mainstream America life resulted in the forced conversion of tribal held lands. So the Allotment Act was a way for the government to move in and reduce the size of the reservations, have surplus land to give out for settlers. And so what they literally did was they gave an allotted portion of land to each individual, each adult within the reservation. And then they took all the surplus land and reduced the size of the reservation, per se. Across the country, over 90 million acres were taken that way. This slide pretty much speaks for itself. Native people became citizens only in 1924. And that was an order signed by President Calvin Coolidge at that time. So in 1934 to 1945, that's the Indian Reorganization Act time frame. That era, a more progressive policy ended the allotment period and began restoring Indian lands. The federal government created programs and projects to rehabilitate Indian economic life. This period was marked by paternalism of the United States government towards Indian tribes. So things started to change in that era. But then we have the termination period, which affected primarily Western Oregon tribes, but I wanted to include that here too, because that had threatened all of Indian country. After World War II, over 100 tribes with rich natural resources were identified as being sufficiently acculturated to have their federal protection status removed. State laws were imposed on many tribes, and millions of acres of valuable natural resource land was taken. These federal policies emphasized the physical relocation of Indians from reservations to urban areas. So this was a way to get tribes or tribal members off reservations, terminate those reservations and terminate their federal recognition, so the federal government wouldn't be responsible for upholding treaty rights and government services to these tribes. The Western Oregon Indian Termination Act, or Public Law 588, signed by Eisenhower, was passed in August of 1954 as part of the termination policy. So what I could say about this is, for example, in my family, my grandmother was from Siletz. She was from one of the Oregon tribes there, but she inherited Macaw land from my grandfather, who passed away. And so she had the land throughout that time from 1855 is when they were terminated. And so the Siletz tribe got reinstated and got their federal recognition back in 1977. And Clallam County here in Washington State wanted to sue my grandmother's estate for back taxes, stating that she was not an Indian from 1955 to 1977. And during that time, her land on the reservation was taxable. So we had to fight that in court. That was a real mess, but part of history. So In my family, I'm the first generation. Me and my siblings, we're the first generation out of the last four generations, or no, out of the last three generations before me. We're the first generation that wasn't institutionalized in the boarding school era. So my mom went to Chamawa Indian School. She was taken at the age of four, forcibly taken from the house, from the home, from the family. And they loaded kids up on big trucks and took them away. And my mom stayed in boarding school from the age of four till she was 18. And then released, but she wasn't taken back to the reservation. She was released to Seattle, to a boarding house in Seattle, start all over. So I'll just go ahead and read this really quick. The American boarding schools were established in the United States in the 19th and early 20th century to educate and assimilate American Indian children and youth according to the Euro-American standards to civilize the Indians. These boarding schools were mandated by the federal government and first established by Christian missionaries of various denominations. So literally, like the Roman Catholic Church was contracted by the federal government, and other church groups were contracted to run these boarding schools. So my mom was, she was raised by the nuns. The kids were forcibly removed from their families, as I said. There was a lot of punishment and abuse. They used these children for labor, and their traditional culture, their life ways, and their languages were torn from them. They were forbid to speak their language. So when my mom finally made it back to Nia Bay, to Macaw, she couldn't communicate with the grandparents because she didn't have the language anymore. And had to relearn all the family songs and languages. In many cases, no visitation by relatives or parents ever. My mom probably had visitation from her aunties and her mom probably four or five times in the whole time, in all the years that she was in the boarding school. And thousands of these children grew up with lifelong depression, anxiety, and trauma. They were, very, it was a very traumatic time for the way they were brought up. So, switching gears here, and we could talk about back in 1944, then tribal leaders from all over the country gathered in Denver, Colorado, and established the National Congress for American Indians. This is a photo of them in Denver, Colorado at the Bamboo Room, where they had their first annual meeting. So NCAI, we'll call it, was established in 1944 in response to the termination and assimilation policies of the United States government forced upon tribal governments in contradiction of their treaty rights and the status of their sovereignty. To this day, protecting these inherent legal rights remain the primary focus for NCAI. NCAI's principles are based right here to secure and preserve American Indian sovereign rights under treaties and agreements with the United States, as well as under federal statutes, case law, and administrative decisions and rulings. To protect American Indian traditional, cultural, and religious rights, to educate the general public regarding American Indian and Alaska Native governments, their people, and their rights. So NCAI, about 15 years ago or so, I got my notes and I can't read them on here, but in NCAI, they actually have an embassy of tribal nations in Washington, D.C. It's right on Embassy Row, and it's a place where NCAI staff are headquartered, and it's also a meeting place for tribal leaders when they're in town in D.C. To go and it was a pretty lifelong dream for many tribal leaders to have such a place like this, to be, have this type of recognition. In the 60s, from 65 to present, the self-determination era. So back in the 60s, President Kennedy actually, even before 65, when President Kennedy was campaigning, he actually, as he toured the country on his campaign, actually met with a number of tribal leaders and tribal communities, and he saw the value of these people, and he was the first light of hope for many of the tribes, as they saw a first president actually really look at them in the eye and acknowledge tribal sovereignty and the role that tribes play in society. In the late 60s, there was a growing recognition of the need to strengthen rather than eliminate tribal governments. That was with the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968. And then in 70, President Nixon made a clear break with the termination policy. He declared termination a failure and asked Congress to repudiate it. And he also encouraged Congress to pass legislation designed to enhance tribal autonomy. Through a series of executive orders, Nixon reaffirmed the trust responsibility of the federal government to tribes. In 75, Congress enacted the Indian Self-Determination and Education Act, acknowledged the federal government's trust responsibility, and directed the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian Health Services to turn over many of the services performed by those agencies to the tribes themselves. So the appropriated dollars that were funneled through the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Indian Health Services at that time to provide those services to tribes, that money went directly to the tribes for the tribes to spend those funds as they saw fit for health care services and administrative services to run their tribal governments. And thus, that led to tribal self-governance. Congress reaffirmed this policy, stating, in accordance with this policy, the United States is committed to supporting and assisting Indian tribes with the development of strong and stable tribal governments, capable of administrating quality programs and developing the economies of their respective communities. Here's a picture of Billy. Here's a picture of Obama wearing a macaw whaler's hat. And he was gifted this blanket at one of the big tribal meetings. President Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Obama and I'm certain Biden will follow suit as well, or if he hasn't already, have reaffirmed the policy of self-determination by either reauthorizing the executive orders originally issued by Nixon or by issuing additional executive orders with control over their own lands and resources. Tribes have made great strides towards reversing crippling economic plight and reviving their unique culture and societies. So here's a controversial policy that we can talk about for a couple of days just on this one slide alone, but the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. In 78, Congress passed this act to protect and preserve American Indians' rights to believe, express, and practice their traditional religions. In the past, other federal laws, such as the laws intended to protect wilderness areas and endangered species, have at times conflicted with access to sacred sites and possession of animal-derived sacred objects like eagle feathers, for example. American Indian Religious Freedom Act clarified that federal laws passed for other purposes were not intended to conflict with Indian rights to practice their traditional religions. And so, if I go really quick, I guess I can just jump back and say, back in the 1800s, when during treaty times and prior to treaty times, tribes were forbid to have big gatherings, and one of those gatherings was the ghost dance. And the ghost dance practice was a practice of a form of native religion that had these big gatherings, and the government officials and the government agents didn't know if these were uprisings or if they were or what. So they kind of forbid back then the practices of that religion, and that carried on into other types of rules that the tribes had to abide by, or they would, be punished. So before 78, it was forbidden by government policies for indigenous people in the United States to practice ceremonies for prayer and potlatches and memorials, name givings, and any large gatherings or celebrations. And those policies were laxed, in the 50s, in the early 50s, but there was never anything that documented that tribes were allowed to practice these religious ceremonies until 78. So I focus a lot with my work for the department on consultation and communication, and then I'm also looking at cultural resources, and so that we properly work with tribes when we come across cultural resources on state lands. So this is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, enacted in 1990, protects Indian human remains and cultural items from intentional excavation and removal, and inadvertent discovery and illegal trafficking. This act also requires repatriation of human remains and their cultural items held by federal agencies and federal assisted museums and institutions and even universities. Literally everywhere we everywhere we go in Washington State or across the United States, we're walking on Indian land. And so these artifacts and burial sites are all over the United States. And we're really taking advantage of, my example would be from the native village, Ozette village of the Macaw people on the Washington coast, where a lot of artifacts in the 70s were excavated and taken and stolen of a Macaw village that was covered in a mudslide. That was like 500 years old, 500 to 1200 years old. So some of the blemishes and bruises and black eyes of the state and tribal relations happened in the 60s and in the early 70s, conflict over Indian fishing rights in Washington. And the fish wars were a series of civil disobedient protests in the 60s and 70s in which Native American tribes here in Puget Sound and the coast along the Columbia River were pressured the U.S. government. They pressured the U.S. government to recognize their rights to fish. And there was a lot of violence at that time in these protests, and a lot of people got arrested. Here's a few photos. There's Billy Frank Jr. on the left, down at Nisqually. The center picture here is the fellow on the right was the chairman of the Puyallup, and on the left, that's Marlon Brando, the famous actor from The Godfather. He came out and actually protested and did the fish-ins with the tribal members. And literally, this photo was taken right before he got arrested with the other tribal members fishing on the Puyallup. So the aftermath of all this history, what do we still see? And we still see prejudice. We still there's still stereotype. There's still suppression, segregation, social injustice, and equality of rights continues to be challenged. And tribes continue to work on their cultural identity to maintain their lifeways. So there's a series of case law that I'm going to skip through, like U.S. v. Oregon, the Bolt decision. We're going to talk about that with Joe Pinesco. And I'm going to move right into the Centennial Accord. I'm doing a quick time check. I got about 10 minutes, so we're going to roll through this really quick. The Centennial Accord is between the federally recognized tribes here in Washington and the state of Washington. So the governor hosts the Centennial Accord meeting annually every year. The accord illustrates the commitment to the parties to implementation of the government-to-government relationship, a relationship reaffirmed as state policy and gubernatorial proclamation that started on January 3rd in 1989. And so these meetings have been going on every year since. This relationship respects sovereign status of the parties enacted and improves communication between them and facilitates the resolution of issues. So what I could say here is all the tribes are signed on in Washington to the Centennial Accord, except with the exception of the Yakima Nation. The Yakima Nation at that time chose to be standalone. And so the Yakima Nation has a separate meeting with the governor and with state agencies, where the bigger meeting, the Centennial Accord, incorporates all 29 of the Washington tribes, plus the tribes that have interests that expand into Washington state, like Umatilla and Nez Perce and others. So the accord is a foundational building block for our evolving government-to-government relationship. It's always an honor to meet with tribal leaders. A vibrant and thriving tribal culture is important to all Washingtonians. It is part of who we are as a state, quote Governor Jay Inslee. Here's a few photos of the governor with some of our tribal leaders. A spinoff from the Centennial Accord is the Millennium Agreement that I'll go ahead and just read through this real quick. Institutionalizing the government-to-government relationship and preparation for the new millennium. The work of this, the 1999 Tribal and State Leaders Summit will be the foundation upon which our children will build. A strong foundation for tribal and state relations is needed to enable us to work together to preserve and protect our natural resources and to provide economic vitality, educational opportunities, and social service and law enforcement that allow the governments to protect, serve, and enhance their communities. On the international front, there's the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and this is a part of the United Nations Declaration, where a number of Northwest tribes provided testimony related to the proclamation of their rights. And a lot of that testimony was about fishing and hunting here in the Northwest. The Treaty Rights at Risk Initiative came out going to say in 2011, and Jim Anderson's on this call, and he might stand to correct me, but I believe it's 2007 or 11. Billy Frank said, "We are losing the battle for salmon recovery in Washington, in Western Washington, because salmon habitat is being damaged and destroyed faster than it could be restored." The Western Washington tribes worked on a white paper outlining the issue and offering solutions for the protection of tribal treaty rights and recovery of salmon habitat, calling for the federal government to take charge and protect treaty rights, treaty guaranteed resources by addressing habitat. You can go to the Northwest Indian Fishery Commission website, and there's a link to the Treaty Rights at Risk white paper. Okay, I was right. So in July of 2011, Billy Frank and a delegation of Western Washington tribal leaders went to the White House and presented the white paper and got their attention. Treaty tribes called for the federal government to align its agencies and programs and lead a more coordinated salmon recovery effort, urging the United States to take charge of salmon recovery because has the obligation and the authority to ensure both salmon recovery and the protection of tribal treaty rights. With the impact to the tribes on the decline of salmon, tribal leaders were calling out, you know, what good is their treaty right if there's no treaty resource. So in treaty rights at risk, that, you know, it called for habitat restoration and conservation, the immediate needs, development of land development and the impacts there. It calls out permitting, local government regulations, called on EPA on water quality standards, water quantity, climate change, ocean acidification, and large industry impacts. So tribal sovereignty in the United States is the concept of the inherent authority of indigenous tribes to govern themselves within the borders of the United States. Self-governance provides federal recognition to tribes, the authority to manage their own governments, flexibility to structure their programs and address tribal priorities and needs. And in self-governance, tribes are able to redesign programs and meet tribally specific needs without diminishing the United States' trust responsibility to Indian people and tribes. So the structure of tribes, we're talking about the treaty tribes here. You got the tribal treaty. You have most all your tribes under the self-determination era created tribal constitution. So each of your tribes have constitutions, they have bylaws. And one of the things, and I'll go back real quick, one of the things about this slide is advise, you know, our program managers and executives and the director early on. You know, when we engage tribes on a government-to-government level, we need to understand them. We need to know their background and their history and what they're all about. And first thing I say is to read their treaty, read their constitution. You could look these documents up and see their structure. Sure, a lot of the Stevens treaties were boilerplate, but each one differs. For example, the Macaw Treaty also identifies the ocean and also identifies whaling rights. So the structure of tribal government, typically you got your treaty and constitution. We have the general council, which are the people, and then they elect the tribal council, and so the structure of the government goes down to you have your executive or your CEO or your general manager, and your administration, and then tribal governments have programs or agencies or departments for natural resource and environment, healthcare, education, social services, cultural and historic preservation. You got planning and economic development. You got public works, and you got judicial and public safety and law enforcement. They're just miniature governments that have all of these elements. Um, tribal capacity and resource management and ecology, Native people are very connected to and relying on their natural resources. It's very important to them. It's probably the most important issue today with Native tribes. Ecosystem-based approach to management. So a lot of the tribes have an will refer to ecosystem-based approach to management. So they're looking at the whole ecosystem as they make these management decisions. And they base these management decisions on science as well as historical knowledge. And they're data rich. They have a lot of data. Today, tribes base management decisions on science and maintain their historic position. Working effectively with tribal governments, I coach the department staff on how to work and approach the tribes, to do that homework, to study their history. What is their story? What's the story of that tribe? And just have a good understanding of them. Look at their website and how they describe themselves. Being respectful and honest goes a long way with tribes that have such a history. And you're from the state government and you're here to help. So you have to break the ice with the tribes up front and really reassure them that that there's sincerity in the work that we do and the work that we share with the tribes. Tribes always call on early engagement. They want to be engaged early in the process. I'm running a little bit over time here, so I'm just going to speed up a little bit. Consultation and coordination. We just, in this past November, we created a consultation and coordination with tribal governments policy for the department. So we have a new internal policy, first ever for this agency to work with tribal governments. We do a lot of informational sharing and a lot of work. We work with the tribes daily. I'm just going to roll through a couple of these. The political position. I want to talk about this slide real quick. The Western Washington tribes and the tribes throughout Washington state are some of the most politically clout tribes in the country. And I mean that by, you know, they have lobbyists in Washington, D.C. They have lobbyists in Olympia. They really stand they stand on their tribal rights, their treaty rights, and their sovereignty. They have strong legal representation, and so they're very political. Politically clout is the way I could describe it. And so that's my presentation, and I'm going to go ahead and turn this back over to Joe Panesco. I'm going to stop sharing. And so, Joe, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So we've got this whole thing blocked for 120 minutes, 2 hours. So we are stopping at 10. There's another meeting at 10 that at least some commissioners have to attend on Columbia River, I think, something. Anyhow, so we have a hard stop at 10 o'clock. So we're not actually going to take a break. So if any one of you need to take a break, just step out and we'll keep going. And, this is being recorded and we can also share the PowerPoint presentations with everybody. So I'm going to jump into mine, and then we'll see if I can get to my goal is to get to my slides pretty quickly, and then just have questions and discussion at the end. But if someone has a pressing question on one of the slides, also feel free to just jump in. You don't need to click your share hand or anything. Just unmute yourself and pipe in. I can deal with that. So, gonna share this. And is that upright?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, it's good.
Yep, we see it.
Okay. Great. But unfortunately, hold on a second. One of the things is I have two monitors. I should be able to show my I should be able to see on my second monitor my notes, and it's not letting me do that. So I'm going to stop sharing and try this one more time, and do what I did last time. If I share the presentation first, when I'm not in the presentation mode, and then go to the presentation mode, that worked. So, are everyone still seeing the right slides?
Yeah, it's
I think
good, Jeff.
so.
Excellent. I can see my notes now. Okay. Get the cameras out of here. So I stole Jim's beautiful cover slide on working with tribes. I'm going to be focusing on the legal history and talk about co-management from the about how co-management has sprung in a large part out of the legal history. Disclaimers. So most things on the legal realm are not absolute. For many of the statements that I've got in some of these slides or this training, there are likely going to be exceptions and nuances that exist. This presentation should not be construed as legal advice. This is an open public meeting. Anyone can view that. I'm not providing legal advice here. These are just general level observations from my own personal experience in working with tribal issues for over 20 years now. And the opinions in this training, these are my opinions, not those of my office, my boss, and I'm not speaking officially on behalf of Fish and Wildlife either. So there are all the disclaimers. So the treaty as a contract. So all of the treaty tribes signed treaties, and in those treaties, they agreed to cede their territorial claims in exchange for established reservations, promises of support by the federal government. And those treaties reserved for those tribes certain, so on reservation, everything. They have sovereign control within their reservations. Off reservation, the treaties reserve certain rights. Most specifically, hunting obviously directly concerns the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife and the commissioners. So that will be the focus of this presentation. When we talk about, you'll hear discussion about ceded lands, and each of the treaties with singular tribes or groups of tribes have an effort. They were negotiated in late 1854, 1855, bleeding over into 1856. The most developed at that point in time, it was still, widely developing. The settlers were still coming in, surveys were still being done. The treaties attempted to describe geographically the area of land that each of the tribes signing the treaty laid claim to and were relinquishing claims to. And so there are geographic descriptions in each of those treaties, and those are the ceded lands, the Stevens intent claimed by the tribes, so that the treaties could then relinquish those lands
Hey Joe, you're
to the
breaking up.
federal
Your
government and just
voice is breaking
preserve
up.
for the tribes. All right. What? Let
Maybe turn off your
me
camera.
try turning off my VPN.
Hey
Yeah, I'll
Joe,
turn
this
off
is
the camera
Barbara.
first and see how that goes.
Joe,
Yeah.
just a
Yes.
quick question. Just one of the good thing about this is we can ask silly questions, but just to get these terms straight. Is a treaty tribe then a subset of a federally recognized tribe, which is a subset of the tribes that exist in the state? the real question is the difference between a treaty tribe and a federally recognized tribe.
Yes, so they're different. As it happens presently, all tribes with treaty rights in Washington state are federally recognized. So treaty tribes could be viewed as a subset of federally recognized tribes presently. That was the federal government's process for formally recognizing tribes has ebbed and waned over time. Jim talked about a history where there was a federal effort to disestablish tribes. So the whole where they stopped recognizing a number of tribes. At the time of Bolt's ruling in 1974, all right, is my mic still working okay? Because I just got a note that my internet is unstable.
Yes.
Is it better?
It's better, okay.
Yes. Okay, yeah. I'm just going to keep going. At the time that Bolt ruled, there were actually two of the tribes that were in front of him who were not at that time federally recognized, and nonetheless, he found that their history, that they had established to the court through evidence that they had maintained a political continuity since treaty times. So he recognized two tribes as treaty tribes, even though the federal government at that time had not federally recognized them as officially as a tribal government acknowledged by the feds. Since Bolt's ruling, the federal government has officially recognized both of those tribes as federally recognized. So you know, historically, there were times where tribes were acknowledged by the courts as a treaty tribe with treaty rights, but were not acknowledged by the federal government. Presently, all tribes with treaty rights in Washington state are federally recognized. And that's sort of they're separate but parallel processes. The treaty right acknowledgement is something that's been done through the courts. The federal recognition, of course, is done administratively through the federal government.
Okay, thanks for that. Didn't mean to take you off course.
So when people talk about that's okay. When you talk about ceded lands, it's generally a geographic were practically incomprehensible, or there were geographic inconsistencies that if you're tracing points, there was a reference to something that just absolutely doesn't work. For example, the Point No Point Treaty for the Hood Canal tribes. In describing the ceded areas of the tribes around Hood Canal, there's a line that calls to go to the Cascades, which the Hood Canal tribes did not go to the Cascades. And it was just a drafter's error. They meant the Olympics instead of the Cascades. So there's been difficulties in understanding the ceded areas that had to be sorted through. And I've got another reference about that later in the presentation. So treaty tribes are tribes that are acknowledged by the courts as having a political continuity back to the 1850s to the same group of peoples who signed the treaty with the federal government. There are executive order tribes. So some of the tribes refused to sign treaties or were simply not offered treaties. And some of these non-treaty tribes were then acknowledged by the federal government through executive orders, and some of them were granted reservations through legislative action or executive orders. And for purposes of this presentation, when we talk about executive order tribes in Washington state, we are talking about tribes that are federally recognized. And the shorthand are, you know, it's executive order tribes. We got treaty tribes and executive order tribes, and together that comprises 29 tribes in Washington state, 21 treaty tribes, 8 executive order tribes. Most executive order tribes do not have off-reservation rights to conduct activity that would be exempt from the state's jurisdiction or oversight. The one exception to that is the Colville tribe is an executive order tribe. They did not sign a treaty, but their original reservation was very large. The reservation that was granted, I can't remember if that was through presidential executive order or legislative action, but it used to go all the way to the Canadian border. And then later, due to pressing demands by settlers, the Indian agents locally worked with Congress and told the tribe, we're going to make your reservation smaller to free up more lands for settling. So they took away the north half of what had originally been designated as the Colville Reservation. And the congressional legislation doing that retained for the tribe rights on those north half lands. So it's congressional legislation that can, that allows them to have off reservation hunting rights on the north half. Federal law is just as powerful as treaties. So it doesn't really matter that it's not a treaty. It's still federal law. The state is still bound to honor it. So there is a significant difference generally between executive order tribes and treaty tribes, mostly through the off-reservation rights of hunting and fishing. One important concept to remember here is it's some people, and it's easy, and myself in my earlier years and ignorance, think of, oh, the treaties gave these rights to the Indians, the off-reservation rights to hunt and fish. And that is not accurate, and the federal courts have been very clear about this. And the reality is the Indian peoples as self-sovereigns in the territory before the settlers came in, they were sovereign nations or villages or bands. You know, their political structures varied greatly across all the peoples and very likely in most cases would not have resembled what we would have thought of as political states or political nations. Much smaller governmental units in many of the cases. But they had sovereign rights. They could do whatever they wanted to do up until they went too far geographically and ran into conflict with neighboring tribes they didn't get along with. So their rights within their lands were uninhibited and unlimited as a sovereign. Their hunting and fishing rights were that way. So they held those rights. The Aboriginal rights is one phrase people have used. So when they signed the treaties weren't giving them those rights. They already had those rights. And those rights are being protected by the treaties. So the rights were reserved by the tribes in the treaties, but they were pre-existing rights. So the hunting and fishing rights were the tribes' sovereign rights from times immemorial, and the treaties are merely protecting them as a level of federal law. And it's an important point because you will offend some tribal peoples if you suggest that those rights were just given to them by the federal government, and that is absolutely incorrect. The treaty rights belong to the tribes as a political entity, and they're not the actual property of any individual tribal member. Only tribal members may exercise treaty hunting and fishing rights. There are some unique exceptions in some tribes in cases of spouses being able to assist, even if the spouse might not be a tribal member. That's pretty rare, and it varies greatly from tribe to tribe. Members of one tribe cannot exercise the treaty rights of another tribe. And while the treaty rights are not the property of any individual tribal member, of course, an individual tribal member has the right to exercise those treaty rights and can invoke those treaty rights as a defense to, for example, the state asserting state jurisdiction over that person's conduct. So the statistics again, Jim had them. Yeah, question?
Joe, this is Jim Anderson. One point with regard to back on the other slide, if you go back to that, the some tribes, there are sites, places where individuals have a proprietary sense of use. For instance, Wickiups or on the river or what have you, where that's where the family's always been. So there's that kind of aspect to that. And then also, treaty rights are place-based, and maybe you'll get to that, but one tribe can't go over into another tribe's usual and custom area.
So. Right. Yep. Yeah, we'll get into that when we get into the Bolt decision. So again, 29 federally recognized tribes, 21 of them hold treaty rights, 8 are executive order. There are 3 out-of-state treaty tribes with treaty hunting or fishing rights. So Jim talked about the Nez Perce and the Umatilla. Both the Nez Perce and the Umatilla have hunting rights in Washington state. The 3rd out-of-state treaty tribe with some rights is the Warm Springs in Oregon. They have fishing rights in the Columbia River in Washington's jurisdiction. So that's the 3rd one that you'll see. And I haven't researched it. Apparently, though, I have not heard that the Warm Springs assert any hunting rights in Washington's uplands. It's just fishing rights. That's all I'm aware of. And as Jim pointed out, there are a number of additional non-federally recognized tribes or tribal groups. Some of them are have attempted recognition or been recognized in the past and lost and are fighting back for it. Two examples, the Duwamish tribe are fighting for recognition. The Chinook tribe, which are the, you know, some of the Indian peoples who welcomed Lewis and Clark on their expedition, they've been seeking recognition. They're still fighting for it. Then there are some other groups as well. And because we're talking about off-reservation hunting and fishing rights, I'm not going to spend any further time talking about those. So Jim talked about the Stevens treaties. He talked about Isaac Stevens. Here's the list of treaties for Washington state that we deal with for hunting and fishing rights in the Northwest. This is separate from the Columbia River. So the Treaty of Olympia was signed with the Quinault, Ho, and Quileute Indians. Treaty of Point No Point, also, you know, generically, geographically, that's the Hood Canal Treaty. And that was the Jamestown Squallam, Port Gamble Squallam, Lower Elwha, and Skokomish. There was another group, the Chimicum, that essentially, that tribe, it's my understanding, essentially, they were extirpated in the late 1800s. They were killed off. There was, and one rumor that I heard is that there was warring going on with neighboring tribes, perhaps the Suquamish, but don't quote me on any of that. If you look up the Chimicum, you can look into that. And whatever few members were left, I believe may actually be members of one of the Squallam tribes. Treaty of Point Elliott is the largest treaty in terms of the number of tribes that signed it. I'm not even going to read them all. They're on the list. Treaty of Nia Bay was one of the singular treaties that was signed just with the Macaw. Treaty of Medicine Creek is the South Puget Sound Treaty with Nisqually, Puyallup, Squaxin, and Muckleshoot. And in smaller print, because they don't, it's not really as big of an issue in USD Washington, Treaty with the Yakimas, Yakima Confederated Tribes and Bands, that was signed in Walla Walla. One interesting aspect to look on here, if you notice it right in the middle, Muckleshoot, it went back. Muckleshoot is on the Treaty of Point Elliott. They are also on the Treaty of Medicine Creek. And that is because the Muckleshoot, one of the points here, you know, we talk about these tribes and these groups. When Stevens came in with the federal government, they didn't acknowledge or appreciate the cultural differences. They took many Indian peoples from many different villages, bands, and places and sort of lumped them together and tried to work with them as a larger group and just had a whole bunch of people sign. Some of these groups did in fact have internal political continuity on their own, like the Macaw. It functioned as a tribe pre-settlement. Other groups were essentially federal artificial creations of a bunch of different peoples who may not have functioned politically together. The Muckleshoot is a grouping of Upper Puyallup River peoples and also Duwamish River peoples. So there were different peoples who likely did not have direct political connections themselves internally. The federal government pushed them all together, said, here, you go live in this reservation, may not have even been where their villages were originally located, and says, we're going to treat you as one political entity. Muckleshoot's one of those examples. Because it's a combination of peoples from different river basins, the Duwamish River Basin is more in the area of Point Elliott. The Puyallup River Basin is in the Treaty of Medicine Creek area. So that's why that tribe has signatories of both. And the Yakimas, there is some disagreement between the state and the Yakimas over, you know, this table is reflecting United States v. Washington case law, the tribes that participated in United States v. Washington. The Yakimas did participate in U.S. v. Washington, but they don't have usual and custom fishing grounds and stations in any of the marine waters in the Northwest, is the state's position. The tribe disputes that. The Bolt decision acknowledged the Yakimas some usual and custom grounds and stations in the rivers coming down the west flanks of the Cascades. That's the portion that the state agrees with. But whether those rights extend into the marine waters of the Sound, that is a dispute that has never been resolved. I don't have a table for the tribes on the Columbia River, but it is the Yakimas, the Umatillas, the Nez Perce, and the Warm Springs tribes. And those are the tribes with treaty fishing rights on the Columbia River. So when I talked about ceded areas in each of the treaties, this is a map that you can find on Fish and Wildlife's website. And it is Fish and Wildlife's best effort to try to identify by color, and I can't really zoom in on this. If you open the map from the website, it's a huge map file size in terms of file size, because you can zoom in and maintain the details. And the tribes will not necessarily agree with each of these efforts to describe the boundaries of each of the ceded areas, but this is the map that Fish and Wildlife works with, Fish and Wildlife Enforcement works with, for purposes of hunting enforcement issues. So, hunting and fishing treaty language. We're going to jump into this more. This is generally the clause in each of the treaties for the Northwest tribes, and there's a few subtle variations that ultimately don't have a significant impact on our legal management issues, but it is the right of taking fish at all usual and accustomed grounds and stations. That is the UNA acronym you will see, or abbreviation, usual and accustomed. Grounds and stations is just left out of it. It's just UNAs. So the right of taking fish at all UNAs is further secured to said Indians in common with the citizens of the territory, together with the privilege of hunting, gathering roots and berries, and pasturing their horses on open and unclaimed lands. Not every treaty had a phrase about pasturing horses. Not every tribe had horses. Some did, some didn't. There's another phrase that's not included in this quote that talks about, that excludes this right from shellfish beds that are staked or cultivated. And that has come up in some portions of USV Washington and been litigated to me to see what the meaning of that is. So one of the things to note here, the first half of this is focusing on the fishing right. And it ties the fishing rights to usual custom grounds and stations. And it talks about in common with. The second half is sort of separate language that doesn't connect intrinsically to language in the first half, you know, together with the privilege of hunting, gathering roots and berries, and pasturing their horses on open and unclaimed lands. So the case law has tried to sift this out and figure out what this language means. Someone may point out that, hey, the top half talks about the right of taking fish and the bottom half talks about the privilege of hunting. That has been addressed in one criminal case where it was a hunting charge, state criminal hunting case against a tribal member. And the court there looked at it and says, yeah, the tribes negotiating the treaties in the 1850s, they would not have understood any difference between those two terms. We think those two terms should be read to mean the same thing. It's the right of the tribes to engage in these activities. And so there is no difference there according to the case law. So I want to start with the historic state interpretation of the treaty fishing rights, because that sets the stage for the unfortunate and uncomfortable history of the state of Washington government's treatment of the tribes and the neglect of their treaty rights. And basically from statehood on, the state's perspective was that it could manage tribal hunting and fishing activity. And this got litigated in the Washington State Supreme Court in 1916, where the Supreme Court ruled that in common with, the phrase in common with from the treaty, simply means that Indians are subject to the state fishing laws. They have to fish in common with, meaning following the state's laws. And the 1916 decision was a conviction of a Yakima member called State v. Towesnute, 89 Washington 478, and there was another companion case, I think it was a Lummi member, State v. Alexis, 89 Washington 492. And if you were to go back and read the Towesnute decision, it has atrocious racist language, talking about the Indians as savages, essentially as quasi-humans, saying, wow, our government's done so much treating them so nicely, and it's a surprise that we gave them any lands at all or any rights at all. They're inferior. I mean, it's unbelievably sad language to read. And in the Towesnute decision was actually just last year vacated by the state Supreme Court. In an order that it recognized that it was very unfortunate and inappropriate language, and it vacated the criminal conviction that resulted from the Towesnute decision. And checking my notes here, and in fact, just parallel to that vacation, it was only in 2014 where the state legislature added a statute in RCW 996060. That allows for any tribal member or family members who are descendants of deceased tribal members who were convicted of violating state criminal fishing laws prior to 1975, there is a statute enacted in 2014 that allows the family members, or if they're still alive, the original fishers, to get those cases vacated if in fact those cases were charging them criminally for exercising their treaty fishing rights. All right, got to keep moving on. So the early history of the state's treatment of the Indians was to completely deny them any rights under their treaties. It was like, well, in common with means we can regulate you completely. In 1942, the U.S. Supreme Court got involved in one of these when the state started charging more. They started charging more for the fishing licenses, and they were charging the tribal fishers to pay the fees. And there, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1942 said, no, you can't charge them fees if it's a revenue-producing fee. But implicitly, the U.S. Supreme Court seemed to suggest that the state could otherwise regulate the tribal members and require them to get a state license and abide by the state regulations. So even in 42, the modern understanding of the treaty fishing rights did not come out of the U.S. Supreme Court. In the 1960s, there was extensive litigation between the Department of Game. Remember, before 1994, there was a Department of Game that managed all game fish, and the Department of Fisheries that managed anadromous fish. Food fish is another phrase you'll see in the statutes. And the Department of Game got into extensive litigation with the Puyallup tribe. And that dispute ended up going in front of the United States Supreme Court three separate times in the 1960s. And the U.S. Supreme Court there became much more clear about the strength and extent of treaty fishing rights and held that the state has no ability to regulate tribal fishing, with the exception of a situation where a tribal fishing activity was threatening the existence of the species. There is a line in one of the decisions about, you know, of course, no tribe would have a right under the treaties to take the very last fish out of the river. But that is an extremely narrow exception where the activity needs to be threatening the existence of the species. You know, people talk about the conservation needs, like, well, conservation in a really, really narrow sense. Right after the Puyallup litigation, then you see the big cases. 1968, a case called So Happy v. Smith, and a separate case called United States v. Oregon, and they were merged regarding treating fishing rights on the Columbia River. And there, the Oregon, the federal court out of Portland, determined that the tribes with treaty rights on the Columbia River have a right to take half of the fish. And in 1970, the United States v. Washington, the United States government sued Washington State on behalf of most of the tribes in the Northwest. And Judge Bolt ruled in 1974 that, again, that the Northwest treaty tribes have a right to take up to half the fish in the Northwest. Did I hear someone have a question?
Yeah, this is Jim. I thought So Happy decision was a little bit less clear with regard to the percentage of fish or the take of fish than U.S. v. Washington, but I'm a little fuzzy on that. It didn't set a specific number at the time or something.
The original decision did not, but there was a later ruling by Judge Baloney that isn't even reported because it was a ruling on a motion. And I believe that was actually in 74 that did clarify, Yes, it's 50-50. And Judge Bolt didn't use the phrase 50-50. He used the phrase equal shares.
Right.
And when the case eventually landed in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, so one side note for the lawyers, Judge Bolt ruled in 1974, that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit affirmed it. That was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court denied review. So the direct effort to get review by the U.S. Supreme Court was denied. But there was a multiple subsequent disputes that did get in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and that is the passenger fishing vessel case of 1979, where the U.S. Supreme Court did review all of Judge Bolt's ruling, even though it was an indirect path to get there. And the U.S. Supreme Court upheld pretty much every aspect of Judge Bolt's ruling. And there, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified that, well, 50-50, it's up to, the tribal share is up to 50%. The U.S. Supreme Court suggested that if a tribe did not need up to 50% to achieve a moderate means of living, then maybe the tribal share could be less. There have been prior aspects or prior disputes in U.S. v. Washington where the state tried to argue that and tried to argue that the tribal share should be lower. And the state has never succeeded in that. And the state hasn't tried that in over 20 years. So it seems unlikely to me that there would really if there's any likelihood of the share really being changed from 50-50. So what did Judge Bolt say in common with means? Well, I just sort of covered that. Tribes collectively get 50%. The river by river, run by run approach for anadromous fish, with each tribe having a right to some portion of the total tribal share that passes through their UNAs. This is massively complex. And this is one of the things that makes it very difficult for fish and wildlife managers to negotiate with tribes that the commissioner should be aware of. This is a lot of the USV Washington, or the North of Falcon process is working these things out. Generally, there are concepts, there are what's informally referred to as terminal tribes, because there's tribes like the Squaxin, Nisqually, Puyallup, whose reservations are located on the rivers where the salmon are returning to spawn. So it's the terminus, it's the end of the salmon's runs where they're mostly harvested by those tribes. And each tribe is on a different river and they have runs going to those different rivers. Well, when state citizens or more ocean-going tribes like the Macaw are harvesting off the coast or in the strait or in the open waters of Puget Sound, whose fish are they catching? What share does that come from? And the fish biologists actually have statistical models suggesting that if you're fishing, say, in the straits at a certain point in time, X percentage of a particular kind of fish that you catch would be presumed to be bound for the Puyallup River. A certain percentage are bound for the Nisqually River. So they factor in, you know, how much fish from each river are you likely catching? And this is all based upon statistical modeling and sampling, where they would do fish tags and other means of tracing fish on occasion and do samples and work those statistics. And you'll hear people talk about how the weakest fish run can constrain the fishing decision. So if one particular river has really low run of fish, but 5% of catch out in the strait is presumed to be fish from that river, you can hit that 5% allocation really quickly and max out and say, we can't fish anymore because we might take too many fish from that weak river. Even though there might be plentiful fish presumed to be from other rivers, you've got to stop because you can't sort them out in reality. So that's all I'm going to say about it for now, because we don't have enough time. But that's one of the real challenging difficulties of fisheries management, is working out how much everybody can catch to ensure that the state gets its 50% and that the tribes collectively get their 50%. The third bullet, intertribal sharing, is not subject to state oversight. So it is up to the tribes to figure out how they are going to share the 50% for the fish runs that go through multiple tribal UNAs.
Hey, Joe, this is Jim Anderson.
Yes.
The point about river by river, run by run, really came to a head in the whole V. Baldridge litigation off the coast as well. Just a little bit of background. And so that plays out then in all the Pacific Council activities as well. So it's so that litigation was under Judge Craig, and the whole V. Baldridge was a major court case that finally got resolved and gave some clarity to what you were saying.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it even gets, it's there were larger disputes about, well, what about, you know, most of Washington salmon go into the ocean and can and go through Canadian waters and go up to Alaska. Alaska waters.
Yeah.
And so then the question was, okay, so if Alaskan citizens are harvesting up there, whose catch share does that come out of? You know, when Canada takes fish, whose catch share does that come out of? So those were all different disputes that have been argued as well.
And the Pacific Salmon Treaty was some of the basis for that, was that very question.
Yeah. The last bullet, for shellfish and non-migratory species, these fishery resources are allocated geographically. For intertidal shellfish, it's shared on a beach-by-beach basis. For crab and gooey duck, they're shared more geographically. There was a whole aspect of shellfish sharing and treaty rights for shellfish. That was a separate portion of USV Washington that, for purposes of this morning, we don't have time to get into. So I'll keep going on it. The bottom line from the USV Washington litigation with respect to fishing rights is the state has almost no say in tribal fishing activity. It's extremely narrow. The state can regulate the exercise of treaty harvest rights only when necessary to achieve a legitimate conservation necessity purpose. That goes back to that
you know, you're threatening the existence of that run. The regulations have to be the least restrictive possible, and they have to be undertaken in a non-discriminatory manner where the state applies those regulations to its regulated citizens as equally as it expects the tribal members to follow them. And frankly, this doesn't usually happen. The tribes in the state are successful enough in coordinating their harvests where I am not personally aware of a time where the state has had to go to court to attempt to regulate tribal fishing. Other than there have been occasional opportunities more recently where the challenge is intertribal disputes where you have multiple tribes who share fish in a particular area or run, and they're arguing with each other. And we've seen circumstances where they end up sort of having a race fishery and they could potentially overharvest the tribal share. So there have been circumstances where the state has seen situations believing that the tribe's harvest collectively may exceed the tribal share, where the state has had to speak up and say, hold on a second, this is unsustainable. But that is not common. So managing a shared resource, while neither the tribes nor the state can dictate what the other group does, our rights are to a common and limited resource. So the harvest decisions have to be coordinated to prevent overharvest. After Judge Bolt ruled in 1974, there were extensive disputes attempting to share that managed or attempting to manage that shared resource. And the state was outright hostile to Judge Bolt's decision. Remember, we had two separate departments, Department of Fisheries, Department of Game. And it got so bad with those agencies essentially ignoring Bolt's ruling that the federal court actually stepped in, issued a mandate, and took over management of the state's fishing regulations to ensure that the state's fishing regulations were not cutting into the tribal share. And that was for a period of the 70s where it was that bad. Judge Bolt created a fisheries advisory board under the court's structure. And the Fisheries Advisory Board existed for the tribes and states to bring technical disputes in front of. And the advisory board would issue a suggested outcome. And if the parties agreed to follow it, then they would follow it. If the parties still disputed it, then they would have to go to court. In the 1980s, there was an average of one dispute to the FAB, that's the acronym for the Fisheries Advisory Board, you'll hear, once per week. And an average of four of those a year ended up going to court. And the parties were fighting constantly. Tons of pleadings over different disputes over different fish runs with different tribes and the state. The court docket became so confusing amongst the disputes when a brief came in. Well, which dispute is this brief for? Because they're all under the central docket number. The court in the early 80s created a sub-proceeding system in U.S. v. Washington. So you will hear this phrase sub-proceedings, and that is used to track individual disputes. And it's a numbering system that has the year. The number, the first two digits are the year. So 89-3 is the shellfish subproceeding. It was filed in 1989, and it was the third dispute of that year that went in front of the court. And you'll still see those. We still use those subproceeding numbers today. And there are over half a dozen subproceedings that are still active in court today. Most of those are intertribal disputes that the state is not directly participating in. So the era of the late 70s and early 80s trying to implement Bolt's ruling was very ugly and painful. The state was not cooperating. The state was still not honoring tribal treaty fishing rights. And Governor Spellman and others worked with tribal leaders in the late 80s saying, you know, all this litigation has got to stop. There's got to be a better way to do this. And that is the birth of the North of Falcon process. In the late 80s is when they started the North of Falcon annual negotiations. There were a number of salmon management plans and consent decrees in U.S. v. Washington that also got entered that start to incorporate concepts of cooperation and co-management. And you'll notice, you know, Jim talked about the Centennial Accord of 1989, same time frame, very much related to this approach towards, hey, we've got to cooperate better and figure out how to do this together. But then we have the Endangered Species Act issues where the Chinook salmon got listed. And that further complicated state and tribal fishing because both the state and tribes have to consult with the federal government for any proposed fisheries that could adversely impact Chinook to avoid Endangered Species Act liability. because any fishery in the Sound could potentially impact listed Chinook. So that just further complicates the whole situation. And it's that level of complication that that imposes the North of Falcon burdens of having to consult with the feds for that, again, for ESA protection. One sub-proceeding that is a very significant one that we're likely to see ramifications of in the future is the Culvert sub-proceeding. So in 1980, as part of USA Washington, the district court ruled that treaty fishing rights also required the state to refrain from degrading fish habitat if it deprived tribes of moderate living needs. That district court ruling was initially partly affirmed by a Ninth Circuit panel of three judges, but then there was an en banc, meaning a very large group of Ninth Circuit judges revisited that, and they vacated the ruling in 1985, saying, well, this concept of environmental protection, the way that the tribes raised it was too hypothetical. It wasn't really ripe for dispute. So they didn't deny the tribes' claims. They just said, now is not the time to give this hypothetical order saying that the state's got to protect the environment. Bring us a real dispute. And the tribes did. In 2000, they came back to court saying, hey, look, we've got very, very concrete evidence about the number of fish blocking culverts under state roads. And we've got very specific evidence about how many miles of fish habitat on rivers and streams upstream from those fish blocking culverts have been impacted. And it was hundreds of miles. And where did the tribes get that data from? Well, the state had actually developed that data in trying to review its road system and culverts and figure out, hey, we've been putting in culverts that aren't very good for fish. What can we do about it? And how bad is the problem? And how do we prioritize it? So the state had been working on it. And the tribes took all that information and took it to court and say, look, they're violating our treaty rights with all these adverse impacts on fish. And that sub-proceeding, the district court agreed with the tribes. The Ninth Circuit affirmed. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which one of the judges, justices, recused, and it was a 4-4 vote. So the Ninth Circuit opinion ends up becoming the law. Got one more slide on it. And this is focusing on culverts under state-managed roads in the U.S. v. Washington case area, which is the one thing that I just should have said. U.S. v. Washington is focused on tribal treaty harvest rights in what the court calls the case area. And the case area for the case is Gray's Harbor, out into the ocean from Gray's Harbor, north to the Canadian border, and then all of the straits, all the San Juans, and all of Puget Sound, and all waters that flow into those water bodies. That is the case area for U.S. v. Washington. So the culverts case impacts those culverts. The Ninth Circuit in the culverts case held that the treaties guaranteed that the number of fish need to be sufficient to provide a moderate living to the tribes. Otherwise, the treaties provide an empty promise. If there's no fish to catch, then that would have been an empty promise to the tribes. And the court ruled that Washington must replace the culverts that restrict salmon passage. And it ordered the states to do that at a very significant cost over the course of years. I think the target is 2028, but don't quote me on that. I wasn't one of the lead attorneys, and I don't have that number memorized in my head. One of the state's arguments was, look, most of these culverts are under state highways, and they were built to federal design standards because the state was getting federal funds for the highways and had to comply with federal standards. And the court didn't care. The court denied that defense by the state and said, it doesn't matter. State, you're on the hook for this. One of the other state's complaints is that a number of the culvert replacements, because there are other downstream blocking culverts or other reasons where fixing the state's culvert isn't actually going to have a real impact in the present time. And that was one of its claims as well. And that was the court did not agree with that. So that's a really high level summary of U.S. v. Washington. U.S. v. Oregon were four tribes for their fishing rights on the Columbia River. So U.S. v. Washington, 21 treaty tribes. U.S. v. Oregon, 4 treaty tribes. The case area for U.S. v. Washington, I just described, vast, many different usual and accustomed areas and overlapping usual and accustomed areas. Columbia River, you're talking about one linear system where the fish are all passing through this linear system. So much less complex in that regard. Third bullet, U.S. v. Oregon never actually determined with geographic descriptions the usual accustomed areas for the tribes. I don't know why. I don't think there was any disputes about it. Although there's my sense now that there are some questions about, for example, south of Bonneville, which tribes really fished historically downriver from Bonneville. But the parties have worked out those disagreements cooperatively instead of having to litigate it and ask the judge to declare anything definitively. In U.S. v. Washington, Judge Bolt definitively declared and described the UNAs for each of the tribes, although the language he used to do so was ambiguous in many cases, and many of the sub-proceedings in U.S. v. Washington have been disputes between the tribes arguing over how to draw the geographic descriptions of their UNAs based upon Bolt's ambiguous language. There have been far fewer legal disputes in U.S. v. Oregon that went to court. U.S. v. Washington has had over 60 published rulings at either the district court level or the Ninth Circuit level. U.S. v. Oregon, a fraction of that. Out of U.S. v. Oregon, we have a co-management organization. CRTFIC is the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And for U.S. v. Washington, we have the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, which Jim is very familiar with because that is where he worked before joining the commission. So again, for time, I've got 9 minutes left. I can do it. Tribal hunting rights. So the second part of the phrase, together with the privilege of hunting, gathering roots and berries and pasturing their horses in open and unclaimed lands. There's been no federal case with all the tribes against the state to declare the meaning of this language. So interpretation and application of this language has arisen in criminal cases, either state or federal criminal cases, where an Indian has been charged with violating state or federal laws, and they assert a treaty right as a defense. And the two main questions that have come up in those cases is what are open and unclaimed lands, and where can they exercise these rights? And there's just three key cases I'm going to touch on. State v. Chambers, 1973, Washington State Supreme Court. An unlicensed Yakima tribal member harvested a deer on private fenced range land. There were no signs posted, but there were fences, and it was a short distance from an occupied house. And the court there ruled that private land is not open and unclaimed. Private land needs outward indications of such ownership, observable to a reasonable man, thus preventing an entrapment type case. So what kind of indications would we want to see? Fencing, signs, buildings, cultivation, gates, things like that. United States v. Hicks, 1984, a federal conviction against a Quinault for killing three elk in the Olympic National Park, where hunting was outright prohibited. The court there says open and unclaimed includes most public lands so long as those lands are managed for purposes consistent with hunting. In a national park set aside for protection of an elk herd where hunting is outright prohibited is not open and unclaimed. The court also observed that the treaty right of hunting, set apart from the right of fishing, because hunting is tied to this concept of open and unclaimed lands, and the treaty negotiators expressly anticipated that settlers would be coming in and claiming more lands over time, the courts have acknowledged that the hunting right was intended as a defeasible privilege that could change, basically become diminished over time as the state was settled more. And that is an observation that has been made in other states back in the Midwest about similar language for the hunting rights. The fishing rights are not subject to diminishment. So open and unclaimed lands, just general, really quick. Public lands that are consistent with hunting. Yes, U.S. Forest Service, BLM, DNR, Fish and Wildlife areas. Public lands not consistent with hunting. National parks, university lands, military reservation, Washington state parks. Going to keep moving. State v. Buchanan. This is the Oak Creek Wildlife Area. We had a Nooksack tribal member harvesting two bull elk without a state license and out of state season. And this is the Nooksack tribal member. Well, Nooksack is northern Puget Sound area, and he's over in near eastern Washington, across the Cascades. And the court here, again, a state criminal case, ruled that the tribe's treaty hunting right extends to the areas ceded in its treaty and described in the ceded area of the treaty, but may also go beyond that and could use additional areas. It could be exercised. The treaty right extends to additional areas that may have been used for hunting and occupied by the tribe over an extended period of time, and also known as areas of the tribe traditionally used for hunting. The opinion in the case doesn't offer a method to determine what qualifies as traditional use. And some tribes argue that their right should be territory-wide and not limited to either ceded area or traditional use analysis. Determining traditional areas for certain tribes has been exceptionally challenging. That is a topic that is ongoing in negotiations between Fish and Wildlife and tribes, and there's disputes and disagreements amongst tribes about how to carry that out. And that's all I'm able to say for the time constraints of this presentation. Commission does have a policy on working with tribes. That's C-3607, adopted in 1998. It focuses on respecting the tribe sovereignty and cooperating and a commitment to co-management. There are some commission rules that acknowledge some tribal issues. The first WAC, the Medicine Creek ceded area in the treaty, is horribly ambiguous and has some absolutely conflicting geographic references. So the state went through a mediation process to get a line established with the Medicine Creek tribes, and that is set out in the WAC. Colville Reservation, the state has banned any non-Indian hunting activity in the Colville Reservation. And wildlife damage, the Fish and Wildlife allows tribal members to participate in wildlife damage hunts in certain circumstances. Fish and Wildlife has done hunting co-management agreements with tribes. I'm gonna skip over the details here because of time. But this is a huge area of work for the wildlife and enforcement programs to work with tribes on these hunting co-management agreements. So last few slides, managing common resources. We got cooperation, consultation, co-management, government to government. I'm sort of ranking these in order of priority. And it's motivated by respect for the sovereignty of the tribes. And it's motivated by the practical realization that we can almost always achieve more by working together rather than confrontation and litigation, especially where nobody controls the outcome of litigation and you don't know what the judge is going to do. This references Centennial Accord, Millennium Agreements. Jim covered those. There is a statutory legal obligation for all state agencies. This was enacted in about 2012 or 2013, where all state agencies must make reasonable efforts to collaborate with Indian tribes in the development of policies, agreements, and program implementation that directly affect Indian tribes, and develop a consultation process that is used for issues involving the specific Indian tribes. So Fish and Wildlife is subject to this obligation as well as all other state agencies. Last slide, takeaways. We got shared resources between the state and sovereign tribes. Decisions by either state or tribes can affect the rights and interests of the others. Working cooperatively will almost always be easier than disagreement, dispute, and litigation with uncertain outcomes. Hard question, does co-management equal veto rights? Can one side say no to the other side and force them to stop? And it's like, well, that's debatable. And there's demanding expectations, government to government consultation before acting on matters that impact tribal interests. That can impact a whole lot of your activities and become very, very time consuming if you look at every single matter that you talk about. So 2 minutes left. Any hard pressing questions? How's that for a race to the end?
Pretty good.
Joe, this is Molly. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
My quick question is, you talked about hunting rights on open and unclaimed lands, but I'm wondering if there's ever been any grazing of tribal horses on open and unclaimed land disputes or issues.
I've never heard of one. So.
Thank you.
Anybody else? So we'll work with Nikki to get our presentations shared with you and the full commission, frankly. Hopefully this was helpful. I'd appreciate any sidelined feedback because, you know, how much it's drinking out of the fire hose. For every one of those slides, I could have gone on an hour if you've gotten the details of them, especially in USV Washington. So it's a good primer, hopefully. Fred, hands up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to both you, Joe and Jim, I really appreciate, as a new commissioner, I really appreciate both presentations. Actually, I'm kind of embarrassed at just how much I learned. So thank you very much.
I second that and absolutely agree with how much I learned.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I've heard quite a bit of it, but I learned and it was a great refresher. So I really appreciated it.
Yeah. It's 10 o'clock. So with that, thanks everybody. Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Okay.
Thank you,
everyone.